You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The glorious and powerful Ode to Joy from Beethoven's Ninth Symphony in D minor, his final complete symphony. It's one of the greatest paradoxes in music that when Ludwig von Beethoven was writing these beautiful passages, he was profoundly deaf, and he'd suffered for years from a litany of illnesses and ailments. University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor Dr. Howard Markell is here with us. So this month marks Beethoven's 249th birthday. Happy birthday, Ludwig. Yep. But boy, he had some unhappy years because of his health.
He had so many ailments aside from his legendary deafness. You know, he had a bad stomach, he had digestive problems, he suffered from chronic diarrhea, he had respiratory problems. He drank quite a bit and probably had liver failure as a result of cirrhosis because he drank so much wine so heavily. And of course, he had depression, which is sort of goes hand in hand with alcoholism, on top of being a superb pianist and conductor and composer who couldn't hear a note.
When did he begin to lose his hearing?
He was a young man. He was about 27 or 28 when it started. And by the time he was 45, he could no longer hear anything.
Well, medical detectives have been trying to figure out what caused all the illnesses and his hearing loss. And modern-day testing figured into that quest. Someone bought a lock of Beethoven's hair?
Yeah. Apparently, a man named Hiller, who was a violinist, came to visit Beethoven on his deathbed. He asked for and clipped a lock of his hair, which was a very common thing that people did for those they loved. They would take a lock of their hair and put it in a locket and save it. And that stayed in the Hiller family until roughly around the 1940s. It somehow got to Denmark, and a physician got a hold of it. He may have been paid in hair, or it may have been a gift. And later on, the family sold it at Sotheby's in 1994, and a urologist bought it for about $7,000. They put it through the hair through a battery of forensic tests, x-ray tests, toxicology tests, and for the most part, it really didn't show much of anything. There was no evidence of syphilis, for example, which is one of the theories behind his ailments. There was no mercury poisoning, but there was a very high lead level. He probably drank out of a goblet that was fashioned from lead, and a lot of the wine of the era was sweetened with lead. The reason why children, for example, like lead paint chips, we've actually discussed
yes.
it, as it tastes like little candy. It's sweet. And so lead was a common sweetener for wine, so that may have been the source as well. And it can cause hearing problems and even deafness.
So that could have all kind of fit in. But as
yeah.
far as all of the myriad of other problems, is it a recognizable syndrome to have had all these?
Well, yeah, maybe, maybe not. There was a syndrome that I had to actually look up that's called Cogan's syndrome. It's an autoimmune inflammatory disorder. And indeed, that could all link in his belly problems, his liver problems, and his hearing problems. But then again, who knows? Because there's no tissue other than this hair, there's no real autopsy other than the one that was performed that said he had a cirrhotic liver. Drinking a lot is not a good thing.
And if it's got lead in it, even less of a good
right,
thing.
Right, yeah.
So as you write that here we have again a famous death and no clear definitive
right.
diagnosis and pretty common condition in medical history. And speaking of medical history, you have a new book coming out, Literatum Essays at the Intersection of Medicine and Culture. 81 of your essays on
yeah.
medicine and the medical issues of all sorts of interesting people. What are some of your favorites?
Well, as a baseball fan, I loved writing about Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig. Babe Ruth was one of the first cancer patients to get an experimental drug that we now give quite routinely. And Lou Gehrig may not have died of Lou Gehrig's disease. He may have just been hit in the head too many times by baseballs and bats. So that was kind of fun. I liked writing about presidential health because for some reason people love presidents and they love death. And so dead presidents is really a boffo way to get people's attention.
You are a pediatrician by trade. You teach at the U of M Medical School. So when and how and why did you get into this area of medical history and medical detective work?
Well, I got into medical history as a medical student, and I had a wonderful teacher here at Michigan named Horace Davenport, who was a famous physiologist. He actually discovered why the stomach doesn't digest itself. I was a recovering English major, and you know the first few years of medical school are just memorization and terrible. And so he was working on a history of the medical school, and I didn't even know medical history existed before that point. And then I went on. He actually told me, you know, you're going to have to get a PhD. That's the last thing a medical student wants to hear when they're in the thick of medical studies. But I indeed did that at Johns Hopkins and then came back to Michigan and have been studying medical history ever since. It's been a wonderful career.
How much digging around in research does it take for you to write, let's say, the infectious disease that sprung Al Capone from Alcatraz or the medical history that helped make Thomas Edison an inventor?
Well, it depends on the topic, and it also depends on the source. So if I'm writing one of my books, for example, I tend to do a great deal of primary research of looking at documents in archives, piecing things together. If people are alive, I'll do oral history interviews and so on. When I'm writing for a news source, whether it's the New York Times or PBS, I have to be far faster because there's a deadline that's looming. And so the wonderful thing about writing about anything today, particularly history, is that you carry the world's greatest library in your pocket. So in the olden days, I would have to go to the library and look up things on microfilm and so on. And so many things are now available on the internet and the World Wide Web that I frequently write these PBS columns over my weekends.
That's amazing. Well, I have so enjoyed talking medical history with you through these years on Stateside. For someone who once thought she would be a physician and then thought she would be a history professor and became neither, it has been a treat to be able to tick off both boxes every time we talk. So I want to thank you for that.
Well, I want to thank you. The treat has been all mine. Thanks so much. And I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so very much.
We're going to miss you.
Ah, thank you. Dr. Howard Markell, University of Michigan medical historian and PBS contributor, and the new book, Literati: Essays at the Intersection of Medicine and Culture. Howard, thank you.
Thank you.